at the lake, pushes ice in the cathedrals, and the leaves are gone from the trees. Along the highway, they just stand like skeleton bones pushed in the sand. My home, where my love abides. My home, where my love abides. My home, where my love abides.
That's Charlie Parr with his Temperance River Blues to lead us off for stories and music this week from the Northwoods. Terry O'Brien, Matthew Miltich, Lenny Clark, Joel Kersting, and me, and you too. Stay human.
Paths in the woods along rust-colored rivers, washing iron all the way to the lake. Lies lit in solitude from snow to snow. Heirloom lands with no fence for the gates. My home, my love abides. My home, where my love abides. My home, where my love abides. My that escapes from underneath the streets, hides in doorways and in faces, and makes the lake seem loud. The waves roll and crash and retreat. Ships that are bound from Norway, and they push out over Lake Superior, past across, past the light to the sea. My
Hi, I'm Michael Goldberg with music and stories this hour to mark the end of the firearm season 2018. Hope you got your deer if you were out. I don't hunt myself, but for a few weeks, the proper way to say hello to most anybody is, did you get your buck? And most have a story ready to tell. In fact, you could say that the wintertime storytelling season opens with the deer season. We start today's show with storyteller Terry O'Brien, this piece called One Old Doe.
I'm not a hunter, but I love a good hunting story. I heard my first one when I moved to northern Minnesota in 1972. At the time, I was living in an old hunting shack on the Mississippi, not far downstream from the Leech Lake River confluence, just past Gambler's Point. Rent was free, with the stipulation that the owner and his sons could hunt the property during deer season. In those days, hunting shacks were just that, shacks. sometimes sided with tar paper, uninsulated one-room affairs heated by wood burned in a barrel stove. There might be a radio to tune in the game when you came in for lunch on a Sunday afternoon, but no TV. Sleeping accommodations were generally a couple sets of rustic bunk beds. Water came out of a hand pump. The guys made their marks in the snow at the edge of the clearing. Gals took the path to the outhouse. Nights were for storytelling. Cases of Old Potosi or Fox Deluxe were dragged up to the table. For a crowd, these sturdy cardboard boxes doubled as seating. Bottled beer came 24 to the case. The brown glass bottles, returnable for a premium, made for a cheap drink. This was long before the craft beer movement, and nearly a decade before the birth of Bud Light. The official beer of the American Sportsman was brewed in St. Paul. Schmidt was pronounced locally Smit. Beers were passed, tops popped, the stove cranked, it glowed and whomped until somebody wisely shut her down. All that red wool, this was before the mandatory blaze orange, jackets, pants, bibs, steamed and stank like wet dogs. The stories, as you'd expect, were about the deer sighted, the shots taken, the ones that got away, and the ones that went down. Hunts long past were vividly recalled. Jibes directed at the game warden. Brags and boasts about a buck's weight, the spread of its rack, and the number of its tines. Sneers met the grown man's taking of a spike buck, a yearling and then some, as if the sexual prowess of the human predator is predicated on the size of his prey's antler output. Does received little or no mention. Yet, of all the hunting stories I've heard over the years, from the tales of stalking the trophy buck to the hapless and sometimes hilarious blunders that befall even the most seasoned hunter, like the time Lenny Clark shot himself in the ass during muzzle loading, the story that has endured meaning for me was about one old doe. I don't remember all the details, but there was a drive during which some of the hunters were stationed in stands and others walked, hopeful that they were pushing deer towards the waiting shooters. When these tales are retold, the teller employs a great deal of gesticulation to aid the listener in seeing what the hunter saw that day and what he or she sees again. Over there is the route we took into the woods. Now down yonder is the fence line where we picked up the trail of the deer. We followed it up over that ridge, and here is where that trail gave out. See here? That's the track of the deer. It walked into this here little clearing, and see there in the snow? That track just quits. Quits, I tell you. It goes nowhere. As if that deer just up and disappeared. Now, how do you explain that? The deer hadn't doubled back in its tracks. The crust of snow in that clearing was pristine. There are hunters who can say they can sex a deer by the hoof prints it makes, some combination of size, shape, and pressure exerted by the hoof. The hunter who told me this story said they knew it was an old doe because the 12-year-old in their party was the only one to lay eyes on it. While everybody else was out driving or sitting in a stand, she was back where they'd parked the vehicles, sitting in the bed of a pickup, when the doe stepped out of the woods. The doe was pretty close. The girl saw the gray in its muzzle. When she took aim and started blazing away, blam, 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 blam. Now, you've heard these shots yourself on opening morning or close to sunset on the last Sunday of the season. Five shots, you say, must have got away. I don't remember what the girl was shooting that day, maybe a 410 loaded with slugs. She had to have been nervous as heck, her first time hunting all. She missed entirely. The old doe had eluded these hunters again. Another reconnoiter of the clearing and the mysterious disappearance of her tracks revealed the method of the doe's canny first escape. The clearing was devoid of brush to hide in, and there were no large tree trunks to hide behind, no depressions for a deer to hunker down in. But there were some isolated clusters of vegetation sticking up out of the snow. Upon further investigation, it was discovered that the wily old doe had leaped from clump to clump, landing squarely in the middle of each grouping of vegetation, and in this way bounded clean across the clearing, undetected. She wouldn't have fooled a pack of wolves, but she neatly evaded her human predators. Shortly after this feat was when she faced down a preteen with a loaded gun and survived a barrage of lead. I first heard this story 20 years ago, around the time I turned 50. My sons were grown and had left home. My hormonal production was fading fast, and it seemed that the world belonged to the young and handsome, and always and ever it was, or is, a man's world. My star was setting. I ruefully observed that it seemed the only role that remained for a postmenopausal woman was that of grandmother, and that would be 2 decades later in my future. Somehow the story about the old doe eased my dim outlook. I read what little I could find about the lives of white-tailed does. As a whole, we humans appear to be much more fascinated by the male of the species and his secondary sex traits. What I did learn about does wasn't all that surprising. Does are social animals that live in matrilineal groups. Mothers live with their daughters and fawns. The oldest, strongest doe becomes the matriarch. It's her job to lead the others to forage, to teach, to protect, and warn the herd of imminent danger. These are responsibilities of paramount importance, not to be underestimated. When the herd disperses due to a scare, the younger ones search for the old doe's scent to regroup in safety. Post-menopause, I found new love, with a younger man, no less. Now I am a grandmother, and it just might be the most fun role I've ever played. I intend for it to be one of my finer performances. Life goes on until it doesn't. Sure, there are major challenges. I remind myself to face them head on. Even though my secondary sex traits aren't what they used to be, and now I have lots of gray hair and a few chin whiskers, like the old doe, I still have some tricks in my repertoire.
Terry O'Brien, One Old Doe. Coming up, we get to hear that other deer stand story she mentioned direct from the source. Here's Peter Ostrushko with Bemidji Blues. Thank you. You're tuned to Stay Human, heard at this hour every week on KAXE KBXE. Today, stories from the woods, and in particular, from the deer stand. Terry O'Brien told me to get a hold of Lenny Clark for his story. Lenny is a Grand Rapids native, now spends his winters at Mountain View, Arkansas, where I reached him by phone to tell the story one more time, Lenny Clark and the Black Powder Rifle.
Well, in 1979, I was busy building a house in Cohasset, and my brother helped me, but he wouldn't take any pay for helping, so I bought him a Black Powder Rifle kit. Well, he took me out and showed me how it works, and he said, you should get one of those things. Well, it just so happened a guy at work had a Black Powder Rifle all put together with all the accoutrements, and he was trying to sell it. So I bought the rifle from him. Well, then my brother showed me how to load it and fire it. We started going to a group that practiced, shooting at targets. Well, it wasn't much later. I met up with some guys that decided they wanted to form a Voyager reenactment group. And we formed a group. We called ourselves La Brigade de Jean Blanc, the Brigade of the White Oak. And we would go to schools and show kids all about the Voyager, how the Voyagers worked in northern Minnesota. Anyway, the boys finally talked me into going deer hunting, which I had never done before. The first winter, we went Black Powder Rifle hunting. We went to the George Washington State Forest, which is north of Nashwauk. They were staying in a teepee out in the snowbank, and it was 25 below. I thought, I don't know if I like this or not. But that first deer hunting season, I never saw a deer. Okay, the fifth year. Now we're back at Paul Bunyan State Forest. Okay, the first day, one of the members of the hunting party shot a six-point buck. And we decided to put it in the back of my pickup because I had a topper. And at least it would be in out of the way to where critters couldn't get at it. Well, this second day, my friend asked me to just take his stand because he'd already got a deer. So I went to his deer stand, and I saw a deer off in the distance, and I shot and missed it. Well, I reloaded my rifle and was standing there and a little uncomfortable in his stand, but all of a sudden my rifle slipped. When it hit the ground, it discharged. And like Forrest Gump said, I got shot right in the buttocks. Now, lucky for me, a member of the party heard the first shot and came to see if I got a deer. No. He saw me up in the stand, and my leg was just shaking. And he said, what's the matter? I said, I shot myself. He said, can you get down? Well, I said, I don't know. I was thinking about the crank-ins on the tree, and I thought, well, if I can't make it down, I might be hanging there like a chunk of meat at the butcher shop. And I saw a smaller tree about 10 feet away, and I said, I'm going to lunge for that and grab it and come right to the ground, which I did. But once I got to the ground, all I wanted to do was lay down. Well, my friend was assessing the wound, and he could see where the bullet went in, but he couldn't see where it came out. And while I was laying there, I was looking up at him, and it almost seemed like he was going into shock. And I had I had told myself, I need to just stay calm until they get me to the hospital. But I saw he had a neckerchief around his neck. I said, just take that off and put it on the wound, which he did. Well, then another member came along, and I said, here's the keys to my truck. Well, he happened to come back with a toboggan, my sleeping bag, a bunch of clean rags. Well, they wrapped up the wound, rolled me in the sleeping bags, put me on the toboggan, and away we went for the pickup. Up and over a bunch of dead fall trees, and I rolled off, and they'd have to put me back on, and all the way I'm telling them jokes and singing, it's the second week of deer camp, all the guys are here. We were having a time. We finally got to the truck, and they're all huffing and puffing, but they had to say, okay, one, two, three, and they slid me in the back of my pickup, and there I lay, face to face with a six-point buck. Well, now, the next thing is to get me to the hospital. So one of the members took my truck and started heading to the hospital while the other two decided to break camp. I'm laying there thinking, I got to stay alert until they get me to the hospital. Okay, I'm going through the woods. Yep, trees, 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 trees. He's going to make a right-hand turn. Yep, he made a right-hand turn. Okay, now trees, trees, trees. Oh, he's going to have to stop. Yep, we're on the highway. Oh, look at all the telephone poles. Poles, poles, poles. Wait a minute, what's that noise? Oh, I beat on the window between the topper and the pickup. He opened it up and said, what's the matter? I said, this thing is a four-speed, you know. He said, I'm in fourth gear. Oh, boy, was he going. Well, we finally get to the hospital. They come out with a gurney. And one of the guys says, well, just take the one that ain't gutted. Okay, they got me on the gurney. I'm in the hospital. Now things are starting to go pretty fast. Somebody gives me a shot. Okay. Well, next thing I know, here's the sheriff. Okay, I'm writing this report. I said, just write down. It's the worst attempt to suicide you ever saw. I did remember to tell the nurse, you need to call Minnesota Power, where I work. Here's the number. Tell them I won't be at work today. Wouldn't you know, she calls Minnesota Power, says Leonard won't be to work today. He's been shot. Click. Well, I've got a black powder rifle, which I have not sold yet. I was thinking about putting it above the fireplace with a little brass plaque that says, I ain't shot it since it shot me.
Thanks, Lenny. Okay, here you go then.
It's the second week of deer camp. I got a swollen head. I'm lying with the dust balls underneath my bed. An icy breeze is blowing in through the tongue and groove. My pants are frozen to the floor and I'm too sick to move. I didn't drink too many, only 30 cans of beer. It must have been that last shot that put me under here. It's the second week of deer camp and all the guys are here. We drink play cards and shoot the bull but never shoot no deer. The only time we leave the camp is when we go for beer. The second week of deer camp is the greatest time of year. I remember playing poker, that weasel must have won. He's wearing my new swampers and sleeping with my gun. He's snoring like a chainsaw, the camp smells like a dump. And someone's dirty underwear is hanging on the pump. Muckoo's in the wood box, Ener's passed out on the stove. His flannel shirt is smoking, I wonder if he knows. It's the second week of deer camp and all the guys are here. We drink, play cards and shoot the bull but never shoot no deer. The only time we leave the camp is when we go for beer. The second week of deer camp is the greatest time of year. Vito's crawling through the door, I think he got frostbite. He passed out in the outhouse, and he's been there since last night. Goofus stumbles through the door, he says he got a buck.
I got a buck!
He was coming from the wayside, and he killed it with his truck.
Then Moosty cracks a beer and says, it's time to celebrate. Goof has got the first buck since 1968. It's the second week of Deer Camp, and all the guys are here. We drink, play cards, and shoot the bull, but never shoot no deer. The only time we leave the camp is when we go for beer. The second week of Deer Camp is the greatest time of year. Part two, eh? I wake up in the woodshed with 2,000 empty beers. I came looking for a full one, and I must have passed out here. I crawl out through the door, and I run smack into a buck. He was eating all the apples from the back of Rudy's truck. I grab him by the back legs, and he drags me through the snow. But when he jumps a barbed wire fence, I have to let him go. It's the second week of Deer Camp. There's one more day to go. We haven't had a shave or bath since 14 days ago. The empty pile is growing and nobody got a deer. But it's only 50 weeks to go and we'll be back up here. I go crawling down the road and alley-oop goes whizzing by. For a guy that weighs 300 pounds, that oop can really fly. I take a look behind me and here comes a big black bear. If I make it to the camp, I'll have to change my underwear. That bear goes by the both of us and runs right through the door. He's breaking up the card game. It sounds just like a war. It's the second week of Deer Camp. There's one more day to go. We haven't had a shave or bath since 14 days ago. The empty pile is growing and nobody got a deer. But there's only 50 weeks to go and we'll be back up here. Bruno's cooking bear meat, but no one wants to eat. Cause everything that Bruno cooks smells like Mongo's feet. The poker game's still going and the beer is getting low. All around the deer camp, there's a ring of yellow snow. The bucks we won in poker are the only bucks we got. We spent 2 weeks in deer camp and never fired a shot. It's the second week of deer camp. There's one more day to go. We haven't had a shave or bath since 14 days ago. The empty pile is growing and nobody got a deer. But there's only 50 weeks to go and we'll be back up here. It's the second week of deer camp and all the guys are here. We drink, play cards and shoot the bull, but never shoot no deer. The only time we leave the camp is when we go for beer. The second week of deer camp is the latest time of year. It's the third day of MarsCon, the ending you are seeing. Kerry Dalby won the SmackDown belt and we told him, shut up, Ian! We hope you had a good time, made you laugh and cheer and smile. There's nothing left to say at all. Except for I want time.
Shot no big rack buck. No one ever stops to peek in the bed of my truck. I come home empty-handed cause I got no luck. Yeah, I'm pretty bad at hunting deer. I watch their shows on my TV. Spooks Band's my hero, got a crush on Tiffany. The bone collector Michael Waddell makes it look easy, but I'm pretty bad at hunting deer. I wear my rubber boots, I got a Ziploc suit, a rattle bag and grunt call. Pour out my Taint 69, I use it all the time, but I still got no buck on my wall. Never had blood smeared on my face, but there's cut shirt tail pieces all over the place. My hunting buddies say I'm just a big disgrace, 'cause I'm pretty bad at hunting deer. I got kicked off my own grandpa's farm. He said I couldn't hit the broad side of his barn. To tell you all the truth, I just don't give a darn, 'cause I'm pretty bad at hunting deer. I wear my rubber boots, I got a Ziploc suit, a rattle bag and grunt call. Pour out my Taint 69, I use it all the time, but I still got no buck on my wall. I ain't never shot no big rack buck. No one ever stopped to peek in the bed of my truck. I come home empty-handed, 'cause I got no luck. Yeah, I'm pretty bad at hunting deer. Yeah, I'm pretty bad at hunting deer. One of these days I'm gonna give me a big old buck and I'm gonna show everybody I know what I'm doing. I'm gonna get me a state record, I'm gonna get on the front cover of the North American Whitetail magazine. Bill Durden gonna be calling me up. Michael Wattner gonna want my autograph. Maybe get Tiffany to break up with old Lee. She'd come hunt with me. That'd be a lot of fun right there, bro. Sure ain't looking too good for me right now. All I ever see is whitetail and hearing a deer snorting running off. What's the difference between a rub and a scrape anyway?
Kevin Blake Weldon with his song for deer non-hunters at the close of the 2018 firearm season, which honestly is a relief to me. I mean, I have total faith that my blaze orange cap and the dog's blaze orange kerchief will magically protect us on our walks, but still. You're tuned to Stay Human on Northern Community Radio. Our broadcast is made possible by our listener members. Thank you for being part of it. And thanks to the voters of Minnesota for the legacy funds, including the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which contributes to this and other local programs. We have one more deer hunting story, this one from my friend Joel Kersting, who runs Sumi Hills Kennel. He's busy all winter giving rides on his dog sleds, busy all summer with his endless projects, busy all the time. He's been a deer hunter all the decades I've known him, but I think now he's got the most efficient system for deer hunting that I've ever heard.
I consider myself a hunter. I really like hunting, but it can be kind of time-consuming. And in the past few years here, actually, I've been kind of working on building a house and getting it finished up. But really, the main thing that is a demand on my time in November is I run sled dogs. And I start training as soon as the weather gets cool enough early in the morning. So I try to start training the dogs in August or September. But by the time we get to November, it's usually cold enough, and the dogs are starting to get in really good shape, and now I can really start ramping up the miles and doing longer runs. And, you know, this is really kind of a passion of mine. So last year, I bought a license, and I thought, well, I always hope that I'll get my deer, you know, first weekend. First weekend isn't very good time to be running sled dogs anyway. There's a lot of hunters out in the woods. You kind of want to leave the hunters alone, and you don't want to go running by with a team of sled dogs. Well, last year, every time I had the opportunity, I thought, well, I better get out in the woods and see if I can get that deer. Then I can get back to training my sled dogs. I hunted all season. Didn't run dogs once during deer season. Didn't get a deer. However, towards the end of the season, I had told a friend, hey, if you get an extra one, you know, I could take it off your hands. And by golly, he gave me a call and said, hey, I got you a deer. And he delivers it to me, and I cut it up and put it in the freezer, and I'd go, great. So that all worked real good. And this friend of mine, by the way, he loves to hunt. However, his wife is not really too crazy about venison, would rather not have it in the house. So he's happy to, you know, if he gets a deer, provide me with the venison. This year, I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, you know, last year, I didn't run dogs once during deer season. And I didn't get a deer myself anyway. And I didn't even buy a license. I decided, well, I'm just going to take a few days off at the beginning of the season, and then I'm going to, you know, try to run my dogs, hopefully not, you know, encountering any deer hunters. You know, after the first weekend, there aren't that many hunters out. And then I try to stick to major roads where, you know, hopefully nobody will be shooting at us. So this year, opening day, he calls me about 10 o'clock in the morning. My friend calls me and says, hey, I got you a deer. And he came and delivered the deer to me the next day. And I promptly cut it up, put it in the freezer. And I've been running my dogs, in fact, I just got done with 5 days off work, and I got the dogs run every day. And I've got some venison in the freezer. So that's been working out pretty well for me.
I guess so, Joel. That's my kind of hunting. Rely on the kindness of others. Our last story for today's program takes us away from the deer stand. It's a story about doing a kindness for a stranger in the woods. It's from my friend and neighbor, Matthew Miltich, a story he calls Kind.
It's a gig day. I'll be playing string bass tonight, but it's early afternoon, a Wednesday, the first week of October, and I need to find out if this new, to me, old outboard motor, which I bought early in the week, is better than the one I gave up on after who knows how many repairs, because my friend, a jazz sax player from the Twin Cities, is expecting to fish with me next week. A lifelong dweller in lake country, I've always had a boat in my natal family or owned a boat of my own, started with a canoe, the native watercraft of my homeland, but for more years than I can keep count of. I've owned motorboats, nothing fancy ever, but I've been fishing from motorboats in Minnesota, literally from the age of 3, descended from Croatian fishermen of the Adriatic Sea, and I enjoy days on the water more than I can adequately explain, or perhaps I should say simply, I'm in love with certain bodies of water. I've hunted for waterfowl also from boats of various kinds and conditions in many weathers. If I lived on the plains or in the Mountain West, I'd own horses, but I live here and I own boats. My new mortar, a 15-horse Yamaha from the mid-90s, is screwed to the transom of my old 14-foot deep-wide Lund, which I'm hauling behind my pickup on a boat trailer I picked up secondhand over west of Walker, Minnesota, so nothing fancy, right? And I'm headed to a chain of big lakes in my neighborhood, of which my own home lake is the least last bead on the chain, a little too small for my hoped-for test run. And I'm aware the clock is ticking toward tonight's downbeat, so I'm driving maybe a little too fast on the winding gravel road to the boat landing where I hope to launch, and of a sudden, a red Jeep backs out of a driveway right into the road ahead of me. I swerve left, stop in time to avoid a collision, and get a good look at the Jeep, pretty beat up, and at the driver, a woman with long gray hair, and somehow the Jeep seems alive with black and tan dachshunds. They're sort of bouncing up and down in there, I mean several of them. She pulls forward just enough so I can get by, and I wave, thinking, strange person, and continue to the landing where, without incident, I prepare the boat, back trailer and all into the water, float the boat and tie it to the dock, start the outboard motor, hooray, it starts on the first pull out and park the pickup. I let my pup, Primo, out of the cab as I get out too, and then here is the woman from the red Jeep approaching me. Are you from around here, she asks. Yes, just down the road a piece, I tell her. Have you always lived here? Yes, I say again, except military service and college. Listen, she says, it's my birthday next week. I'll be 70 years old. I drove all the way up here from Dallas to see our old camp. My dad, she says, was an oil man, and he sold the land to the church camp back about a half mile. Do you know that Bible camp on the curve? Sure. Well, that was our land. And he sold our camp to the Girl Scouts, and now it's National Forest. They burned all the buildings. I just wanted to visit our old camp, but the neighbor was very unfriendly and chased me off his driveway. Very unfriendly and blunt. I just wanted to walk in there. Do you know how to get there? I don't know the place you mean, I say. Well, you saw me back out of the driveway. Okay, but I don't know the place you call the camp. Listen, I say, I'm in kind of a hurry. I just want to try out my outboard motor. I have a gig tonight, and I haven't much time. Oh, are you a musician? Yes. I understand musicians because I'm an artist. An artist. What kind of art do you make? I'm a writer, she says, a journalist. A writer. I do some writing myself, I say, but I have to get going. I lived in Las Vegas, she tells me. Oh, yeah, I played in Las Vegas once. Maybe I was there then, she says. What do you play? I play string bass, mostly jazz, but, you know, I have a gig tonight, so I really have to get going. Oh, I love jazz. Do you suppose you could take me to the camp by water? You know what I tell her? To get to that shore from here by land, that's only about a quarter of a mile. But the way the lakes lie out, to get there by water is a couple of miles, and you have to go through a long, shallow channel to get to the other lake. Someone told me I could borrow a canoe, she says. Man, that's a long paddle by canoe, I say. I look her over. She's wearing a simple jacket and thin slacks, street shoes, and this is October. The temperature is mild, but the sky is overcast and very dark. I remember just a week ago, after a visit to the Veterans Administration Medical Center in St. Cloud, Minnesota, how I tried to find my grandmother's old lake cabin between Little Falls and Brainerd, how I discovered the road to her lake place was now posted and restricted to landowners only, how much the nearby countryside had changed, and how I felt about all that, about wanting to see the old place one last time and failing at it. Against my better judgment, wanting to be kind, I say, if you can get yourself ready, I'll take you there in my boat, but only for just a moment, okay? Oh my God, she says, you'd do that for me? You've restored my faith in humanity. She goes back to her Jeep. When she returns to me, she says, I've got to leave my babies in the Jeep. We had an accident in Oklahoma, and two of the dogs were killed. That Jeep was in the war in Iraq, and it's fitted to withstand IEDs. It's worth a lot of money, but I need parts for it. One of the dealers up here said he had parts for it, but he didn't. Isn't that terrible? How many dogs are in there? Just 11 now, she tells me, I think. Uh-oh. But I'm committed now, I guess. And I get her seated in my boat, just an old tin job with bench seats, and the motor works fine, I'm relieved to find, and we just fly across that lake, headed for the channel in this woman's old family camp. She talks the entire way. I have pretty serious service-related hearing loss, and I indicate to her by signs, and then by my own shouted words, that I cannot understand a word she's saying, the drone of the outboard motor and the rush of air across my ears. But she's undeterred. She talks the whole way across the lake, around an island and cruising past points of land and along the meandering watercourse, and finally through a narrow channel and into the next lake, which sports some multi-million-dollar houses on its shores. If my own little lake were part of the Monopoly game, it would be on Baltic Avenue. These lakeside mansions are on Park Place and Boardwalk. It takes a while to find the place this woman is looking for. But when she's certain she's found it, I tie the boat up to a lake-leaning white cedar at lakeside, and she steps out onto the wooded shore. It's all grown up here, she says. It used to be a beach. I'm going to go up and see if I can find the old camp foundation. They burned the buildings. Just please make it short, I ask her. The sky has grown darker yet, and while the woman is away, hidden from my sight by trees and foliage, begins to rumble. I wait. Rain begins to fall. To fall merely? No. It pelts the surface of the lake, rattles the leaves, and drums against the aluminum boat. The rain itself is thunderous, and then literal thunder crashes overhead and shakes all beneath it. The wind rises suddenly and howls. The temperature drops a sudden 20 degrees, I guess. When at last the woman returns, I make a second error in judgment, but she's talking still, telling me the old chimney of the camp still stands and others of her discoveries. And I have to get out of here. Have to get away, get to my gig. We've got to run for it, I say. Probably we should huddle here in the woods. Instead, I get the woman aboard, start the motor, tie off, and run the boat into the open lake just as lightning begins to strike the far shore. I open the throttle as far as it will go as the rain hammers down, shield my eyes as well as I can with my hand, fly to the channel between lakes, push as fast as the shallow passage will allow, and then back into the first lake, my goal the landing and the safety of my pickup's cab as my passenger, in her thin jacket and street clothes, gets hammered by the cold rain and wicked wind. It's a long ride to the landing. I tie up at the dock and shepherd my shivering passenger into the cab of my truck, start it, and turn the heater on and up to 90 degrees. By now she's shaking so violently I know she's in the first stage of hypothermia. My God, I tried to do this woman a kindness, but maybe I'm killing her. She shivers on, but this doesn't slow her tongue. It just makes it harder to understand what she's saying. You've got to warm up, I tell her, and we're going to start your car and get it warm, too. I'm not going to leave you until you're warm and safe. It takes a while, but as the cab warms, so does she, and after we get her car started, she asks me about my service. I was a Marine, I say. I'm all about helping veterans, she says. I sell T-shirts and caps to vets, and those dogs make good service dogs for vets. They're worth all kinds of money. So where did you serve? I served in Vietnam during the war, I tell her. Well, I was a folk singer in the Vietnam War, she says. I try to reconcile what she's just said with my own experience of the war, and I can't. In the war? What does in the war mean? But she moves on and begins to talk about some kind of business she ran in Las Vegas involving services to stars like Michael Jackson, and I simply can't follow. I have no idea what she's talking about. When it's clear, finally, she's out of any real danger of hypothermia and going to be all right, I back the trailer to the lake to retrieve my boat, and I suggest that maybe it's time for her to get into her own car. I'm running late. This produces hardly a pause in the woman speaking, but she wants me to have her contact information and for me to have hers, so I say, okay. I carry almost always one or two blank 3x5 cards and a ballpoint pen to keep notes. I have just one with me today, which I hand to her, and she writes on it and then asks me for my email address. She's filled out half the card, and I fill out the other half, then crease it in the middle, and here comes strike three. I reach for the utility knife on the dashboard. I use this knife with 6-inch curved blade for gardening and all manner of chores around my place in the country. I slip it smoothly from its sheath to divide one half of the card from the other when my passenger screams, "Oh, God, here it comes!" Before the words are completely out of her mouth, I've neatly cut the card in two, replaced the knife in its sheath, and stow it on the dashboard, and hand my half of the card to her. "Oh, I thought it was the end," she gasps. "No, no," I say. "I just keep the knife handy for chores. I'm sorry I scared you." She begins to talk once again. It takes me some very uncomfortable minutes to be able to break into this woman's monologue, for she's forgotten her scare just that quickly, and she speaks without pause. I tell her 5, maybe 6 times that I have to go. When, after many urgings, she climbs down finally from the pickup and into her red Jeep, dachshunds popping like popcorn all around her, I wave to her briefly, put the truck in gear, and pull away, thankful things did not go worse than they have. When I'm well underway, the red Jeep growing smaller in my rearview mirror, I'm relieved to be done with this, yes, but worried for whoever she is, wondering who she is really, and hoping she'll be all right.
Thanks to our storytellers this hour, Matthew Miltich, Joel Kersting, Lenny Clark, and Terry O'Brien. I'm Michael Goldberg with Stay Human. We close today's show with Minneapolis jazz guitarist Nate Brown and Jay Epstein on drums, a piece they call North Country Mile.